Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. We are recording this on Friday, October 30th. And the reason I'm bringing it up so early in the show is because next week, people in the United States go to vote. And obviously, if you have not voted yet, I would highly encourage you to do so. I don't need you. You don't need me to tell you how important it is. But we are not going to talk about the election on this show. By the time you hear this, it may have passed. It is your decision who you vote for, but I just want you to go vote. All right, joining me in telling people what's up, Ara Wagner, welcome back. How are you?
Yo, I'm good. I'm low on pumpkin seeds. I need to go bake more.
Yeah, you have a big night ahead of you.
I do. I have a big night ahead of me. I got to go hit all the grocery stores and buy up pumpkins before they all vanish on November 1st.
You have an addiction, young lady.
Yeah, it's like you don't care about the Halloween candy. You just need the pumpkins.
The Halloween candy sticks around longer in stores. Pumpkins are produce. They go bye-bye very quickly.
I don't know. I hear people go to the grocery stores the day after Halloween and get all the discounted candy like it's their job. Yeah. So
yeah, but it's also going to be a Sunday morning after Halloween this time, so it'll be easier to go to the grocery store while everybody's at church or sleeping in.
You know, Ara, you should find out what they do with all those pumpkins when they all disappear on
November
1st.
They get tossed in a dumpster. I've seen it.
You should find which dumpster.
No.
And then think of all the free pumpkins you have and all the things that might be living on them.
Yeah, the man with the terrible idea you hear is Jerry Hildenbrand.
And hi, everyone. My ideas are never terrible.
No, that was bad. I don't want Ara to die in a while dumpster diving for pumpkins.
Like, there's already enough mold
raccoons
and stuff growing on the pumpkins while they are in the store on the display. Like, I have to hunt towards the end of the season to make sure I don't get a moldy pumpkin. I do not want a dumpster dive for those.
Yeah, I mean, if you can see the mold on the outside, you don't even want to see what's on the inside, right?
I mean, usually, yeah.
A little mold never hurt anyone.
On cheese, maybe, but not on my produce.
That blew my mind the first time I saw that.
What?
People store cheese and let a mold crust grow over it, and it helps age it. I was like,
yeah,
I'm never eating cheese again.
It's an incredible preservation
it's
method.
It's the same thing as beer.
So then pumpkins would be equally delicious and fermented like beer. Come on, you can't.
I mean, there are
pumpkin
flavored beers, so clearly we're solving the world's problems here.
Yes. Yes.
Nobody ever needs to go hungry again because moldy pumpkins will just magically turn into beer, and then everybody will get all of the calories they need. That's it.
And then they can eat the seeds.
Right. Ara will make all the seeds for it. I don't know, moldy pumpkin seeds. If you put those in the oven, that just sounds disgusting.
Yeah, if I open a pumpkin and I see any black stuff on the seeds, I just put the top back on the pumpkin and throw it in the trash. If I'm going to spend 6 hours making a batch of pumpkin seeds, I'm making sure that they are good seeds before I go in for all of that work.
Even I'm going to agree that throwing away blackened pumpkin seeds is probably a good idea.
And this is a man who went to get Laffy Taffy
man
on the highway.
Everybody,
that was great.
Turned.
I only wish they'd had some nerds so you could have sent them to me, Jerry.
Well, I mean, Ara, if you were here, you would have accompanied me to go get all the free candy, correct?
I would have, but I'm also very picky about my candy flavors, so I would have collected the candy and then let you have most of it.
I'm just disappointed that the only available candy was Laffy Taffy.
Well, it was, there were
me
other
too.
Things there, but they weren't. Laffy Taffy is like, I don't know, the boxes seems, or the bag it's in seems to be like indestructible.
Yeah, that's a fair point. If you're going to take candy that has been through a highway accident, Laffy Taffy is probably a decent way to go.
Yeah, the fire company was spraying the boxes in individual pieces off the road.
Oh yeah, that would have destroyed all the candy I wanted, because I would have wanted nerds and those come in a box, a cardboard box.
It's the Twinkie of like boxed candy is what you're saying.
Yep, I'm out though. It didn't last. I need another truck to crash.
Well, Jerry, all the candy goes on sale Sunday at 6 a.m.
Yeah, but it doesn't taste the same as free highway candy. It just doesn't.
Yeah, nothing tastes as good as free, right?
Right.
Anyway, let's give people their free entertainment by actually talking about the things we planned on talking about this week. So, I mean, this has been a busy week, right? The tech CEOs were in front of another congressional hearing. They were grilled by the Senate. We're not going to get into it, but it was a shit show as normal. it's probably no surprise that nobody could pronounce Sundar Pichai's name again, even though this is the second time in like 2 months that he was up in front of Congress.
If you're going to question a man about like billions of dollars in revenue and, you know, information and disinformation campaigns that are critical to the country, maybe learn how to pronounce his name and what the heck he's supposed to be talking about. I mean, I feel like that should be a no-brainer.
At least nobody called him Pikachu this time.
Oh, Jesus.
So we've come a long way since the last time he was in front of Congress.
Is it too much to ask for representation that actually knows how to research its topic?
Yes.
At this point, it's willful. It's something that they just don't care to learn, and it's awful, and it's discriminatory, and it's just willful ignorance, and it's not acceptable.
Possibly.
But Google had a busy week nonetheless. The Pixel 5 launched yesterday, October 29th, as we're recording this, in the U.S. and Canada. It had been available in a bunch of other countries already 2 weeks earlier, but, you know, its biggest market, it's now available. I saw a lot of people on Twitter yesterday getting their phones in the mail, which is great. People love the sort of sage colors. Traffic on our review understandably went up again as people were, you know, thinking about whether they should buy it or reading reviews of the phone as they got it just to make themselves feel better. And, you know, Jerry, you wrote something about the Pixel 5 in relation to Google's flagship phone strategy and how, you know, this may actually, if the Google phone line this year is successful and we learn from the company's, Q3 earnings yesterday that while hardware is still a pretty small portion of its overall revenue, it's growing. And if the Pixel series this year is successful, the 4A, the 4A 5G, and the 5, this may be the last, or last year, the 2019, may be the last year we ever see a Pixel flagship. That's a pretty, you know, worrying statement for some people who may love the Pixel phones. Tell us a bit about why you think this may be the case.
Well, first off, the word flagship doesn't really mean anything anymore.
Thank you.
That's thanks to Qualcomm, because what would you need to do to the Pixel 5 to make it so Android enthusiasts would call it a flagship? Stick a better Snapdragon in it and raise the price by $300. What else can you do? It has everything else. Has a very good Samsung panel with a high refresh rate, wireless charging, waterproof. It's built great. I guess some people might want it bigger. But to me, you know, I think it's just fine. Plenty of memory and storage. So the only thing it's missing is a very expensive processor. I think it was smart for Google to skip that because Google isn't Samsung. Google can get away with using a weaker SoC. Samsung can't, because Samsung phones, let's be honest, they do a lot more than a Pixel phone does. Google has basically said they want the Pixel line to be simple and elegant. You know, it sounds very Apple-esque. And if you're thinking that, you know, Google is trying to copy the iPhone, I think you're right. They are. They want a phone that you know, they think looks good, is easy to use, and performs great, you know, under all circumstances. That last part, they still need to work on a little bit, and they will probably see the Pixel 5 have its own set of weird oddities, because all Pixel phones do. But if you read any review about the Pixel 5, you're not going to find very many complaints about the processor inside it, because it can do what Google wants it to do with the Pixel 5.
There's also that sweet spot of, like, this year has been the year of the $700 phone.
Right.
The the Pixel 5 should be a $600 phone. We've talked about that before. It's $700. It is, you know, it's par for the course that Google sort of acquiesced a little bit to the carriers and put millimeter wave. That's what Google's always done, especially if that carrier is Verizon.
Right.
But you know, overall, this is a $700 phone, and it's up against other $700 phones that really do offer better value if you're looking for specs, and even for features if you go, you know, round for round.
The features, it's Google has got, they've got to hate the fact that they can't add exclusive features to the Pixel phone, because if they do that, and you know, I don't mean just a special launcher, I mean real features that people want.
Call screening?
But Samsung can do call screening. I mean,
not with the automated voice of like, hey, this person has automatic call screening. Tell us why the hell you're calling me.
Not yet, but Google's not going to hold that back. They're not going to hold that back forever.
We've been waiting on that to come to other phones for 3 years now?
But if Google were to do something like, you know, AI features and assistant are only on the Pixel. I mean, big features. Samsung and Motorola and everybody else, it's just, they're going to be mad as hell. Rightfully so. Google's job is to increase the use of Android. If they sell a few phones along the way, that probably makes them happy. But Google isn't in business to sell phones. They're in business to get eyeballs, and they can get just as many eyeballs from Samsung users as they can from, you know, any other brand. Google's happy. Google's really happy with the way things are going. I can tell you that with utmost confidence. Let's put it that way.
See, I sort of posited that. I was talking with David Ruddick about this on the VergeCast episode with when we talked about the Pixel 5. And I posited that, and I said, you know, this is Google sort of accepting its fate as a lifestyle brand, right? And David said something smart. He said, you know, Google would never do that. This is not a company that just goes for, you know, the 10% or 5% of the market, right? This is not a company that just wants to be in the game. They want to win. And if they're in the game because they feel like we're a mobile company, we're an ad company, we have to make a physical product that showcases these, you know, these digital assets in the best way possible. And in that, you know, in that case, it's the Google Assistant. You know, it doesn't make sense for them to just want to sell it to 1 million people or 2 million people. And when you put it like that, I kind of see his point. I don't think Google just wants to make Pixel phones to showcase Android in the best light. They want to outsell Google, they want to outsell Samsung, they want to outsell Apple. They just can't do that.
I completely disagree. I think the only reason they made anything past the Pixel 3 was because they know somebody needs to make a phone that uses only Android APIs and doesn't add any of their own. If you want apps that work on every phone, you need a baseline for developers to use to work with. My honest opinion, that's the only reason they keep trying.
But they're trying something different this year. So let's talk about that.
I really like what they're doing. I can't, you know, I know a lot of people disagree, but Google is never going to be able to compete with Samsung when it comes to selling smartphones. If I know that, the people at Google that make, you know, millions of dollars for the company each and every quarter, they know it too. They're not going to be able to compete. They're not even able to compete with OnePlus. So it was smart to not try this year.
So we have a couple more, about a month or 3 weeks left before the Pixel 4a 5G is available. It went up for pre-order yesterday, the day that the Pixel 5 is available. Once that phone is widely available, we'll have this this triptych of phones from Google this year, from $350 all the way to $700. We've talked about how Samsung sort of has a solution for everybody from like $100 all the way to $2,000.
Yeah.
And, you know, that they're just blasting the market. Ara, when you take a look at this cross section of Google's offerings, how do you think at each price tier, the $350, $500, and $700, compare to their counterparts? And how does that inform what Google does in 2021?
The Pixel 4a 5G is the hardest, I think, to justify of the three phones, but also one that might be the most appealing to some people, depending on how it gets discounted over the next couple of months. Because right now, the Pixel 4a 5G is $500 right now, $600 if you want the one for Verizon. The other phone that's $600 right now is the Galaxy S20 FE. And the Galaxy S20 FE definitely offers a better experience for everything except camera. So it's hard to justify that. The 3A has made a decent niche for itself at $350. It gets some competition from the Nord, but both phones aren't available in a lot of markets because we don't have the Nord, which is annoying. And a lot of other places don't get the Pixel 4A or didn't get the Pixel 4A until like a month ago. And then we have the Pixel 5, which $700 is an area that already has a whole lot of competition. So it's...
I was going to say, how do you think that changes 3 months from now when $100 gets knocked off the Pixel 5 and probably $50 off the 4A 5G? I don't think the 4A 5G
needs to get $100 off too. Yeah, otherwise, the Pixel 5 is going to just absolutely mooch most of the sales off of it, apart from the people who were like, okay, I like the Pixel experience, but I need a big screen. Because that's the real difference between the 4A 5G and the Pixel 5. The Pixel 4A 5G has a big screen and doesn't have wireless charging.
Let's shift a little bit to talk about you mentioned OnePlus Nord. So Nord is a brand that, I don't know, it doesn't have tons of cachet yet in the West. A lot of enthusiasts know what it is because it was released in Europe earlier this year. This £379 phone, Snapdragon 765G, just like a really solid mid-range phone for not that much money. A lot of people were very impressed with it. Android Central exclusively announced that the company would be releasing two new Nord models, both of which would be coming to the US later this year. That has now happened. It's been announced. We have the Nord N10 5G and the Nord N100. So what we have are these two new phones, and we don't have U.S. pricing or availability yet, but we do have European pricing. And the Nord N10 5G is basically a lesser Nord, as we expected, and it has a Snapdragon 690 at a 6 gigs of RAM, 128 gigs of storage, and it has 5G through that Snapdragon 690. It's the first phone with that chipset that we've seen. And it is going to cost £329, which is £50 less than the Nord, which equates to about $430. But what we're thinking is that it'll actually debut in the US at under $350. So, that would be really impressive, and that would take on the Pixel 4a and the Motorola, you know, the Moto G Stylus and the G Power and all these Motorola phones, the Moto One series that are doing so well in this market.
Doesn't the N10 5G also come with 30-watt charging?
Yeah, I mean, it's got all the specs you want from a decent mid-range phone, right?
So, I mean, I think that puts it just a bump above what Motorola's offering.
And yet, it does.
I mean, so long as it supports 18-watt power delivery charging and I can use literally any powered USB-C charger on the market with it, I'm happy.
I used to think that, too, until I finally tried a OnePlus phone with its fast charging. And there is nothing like putting it down there at 5%. Going to the restroom or whatever and coming back 15 minutes later and that sucker's half charged. There's nothing better than that.
I'll agree with you there, but at the same time, I have a Pixel 4a and I can put it at the put it on the charger at like 10-20%, go make dinner, which is like 20 minutes, and then come back and the phone's at 88.
It's got a pretty small battery compared to this.
That's
but it's a more efficient phone.
It makes that battery last.
Although we don't know how well this phone will do in terms of battery life, but
Right.
You know, it has a 4,300 milliamp hour battery. It's got a 64 megapixel camera at the back. It has a wide angle lens as well. And it's got macro and monochrome lenses. And this is the first OnePlus phone that has a 64 megapixel sensor, but we're not sure the quality yet. It's interesting. It's an interesting value prop. This comes right after OnePlus co-founder Carl Pei has left the company. He famously started the Nord brand, but we're not sure whether he was in charge of these two phones, the Nord N10 and Nord N100. So my guess is that he's not, who knows, we're just putting words in his mouth, but we're not sure if he was happy with the direction that this brand was going in. It does seem to sort of dilute some of the value of OnePlus's overall offering, right?
Right. I mean, I like the really cheap N100. I can see that coming in at $200 in the United States. The N10 5G just makes me wish that they would have just released the regular Nord here, and even if they had to change, you know, the cellular radios in it, and people would have been more than willing to spend a little bit extra on it. It's just, I think, without touching either of them, I think it's going to be a better phone than either of the ones we see here in the States.
Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly. I really wish that we could have just gotten the Nord instead of them having to make new models that may or may not be as good as the regular Nord.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to 5G as well, right? Like the Nord,
yeah,
the Nord N10 probably has to have some carrier, you know, considerations, and they're talking about
certainly
the fact that it might be available at carriers. The Snapdragon 690 is interesting. It's got cryo. It's got a cryo core, so cryo 560, which is a big improvement over the Snapdragon 675, which was cryo 460. Yeah. This is the first 600 series chip with a Cortex A77 core, and it's really like it's mainly just the fact that the GPU is pretty underpowered, right? If you're really looking to game, this might not be the phone for you. It supports sub-6 5G up to 2.5 gigabits, which is not bad, right? It's not the 4 gigabits that you get on the 765 series, but it's fine. And overall, you know, it's built on an 8-nanometer process, so it's more efficient than the other 600 series chips that we've used before. It's going to be a very popular mid-range phone, mid-range chipset, and we're going to see it a lot in the next few months.
Yep. I'm going to bet there's a substantial cost savings between it and the new 700 series chips that are going to slowly trickle out.
Yeah, it seems like it definitely makes sense why they're doing this. Qualcomm has been criticized for kind of increasing costs of phones this year by stuffing 5G into phones that don't need it. But this does not seem like it will inflate that pricing too much. The N100 is also interesting at £179. So we're looking at under $200. A Snapdragon 460. Don't know a ton about that one. But
that worries me a little. I want to try that one because it might be enough and it might not. It's one of those chips that just teeters on the edge. So I really want to check that one out. And shoot, at the price it's going to, you know, I expect it's going to come out, you know, it's £179, which is a little over $200, but I'll bet it comes in at $179 in America.
There aren't a ton of great phones under $200.
Right.
You know, this is really going up against like the Moto G Power or the Moto G Fast, which is $199 MSRP. The Moto G Fast has a Snapdragon 675. So this one feels underpowered for the price. And
yeah, and you know, OnePlus has done some magic. We've seen before that, you know, their phones just seem to work better than other phones that use the exact same hardware. So, you know, maybe the 460 is enough based on the price of the phone. You don't expect, you know, to play Crysis on a $200 phone. But, you know, I'm really curious. This is one I really want to try.
So the other thing that's interesting, Harish wrote an article about how OnePlus is turning into Samsung with its newest phones. And, you know, that's a bit of a hyperbolic title, obviously, but it is interesting that they are, as I said, diluting a little bit. I was, you know, T-Mobile is now kind of the primary carrier for OnePlus right now in the US. They're releasing the 8T. They're going to release these two phones in some capacity. We're not sure yet how, whether it'll be the same spec sheet or the same pricing. But what's interesting about these two phones, they're not launching with Android 11. They're launching with Android 10 using Oxygen OS 10.5, which is, oh, I'm sorry. It's not, it is Android 11, but it is not Oxygen OS 11. So it's an older version of Oxygen OS, or at least a lesser version, but it is based on Android 11. I find this very interesting that like they're forking their software in some way. And I wonder why. I wonder what the purpose is.
Isn't a good part of that reason the fact that whenever OnePlus's latest UI came out with Android 11, and everybody went, oh my God, they copied Samsung. We don't think they maybe wanted to take a step back from that and see whether or not they can still keep their own identity instead.
No.
And if I was going to test that out, I'd test that out in the budget segment where phones are going to sell anyway.
I've talked to OnePlus people both on the record and off the record about Android 11 and the Oxygen OS 11 redesign, and they've leaned into it. They said, we are not trying to copy anybody. We are doing our own thing. We have opinions about how we think Android should look and feel, and by no means is this a lesser experience.
Good for them.
I just clarified.
They should.
Oxygen OS 10.5 is based on Android 10, not 11. So it'll be an older version of Android released on phones that are newer than the phone OnePlus just released with Android 11 out of the box, which is the OnePlus 8T.
I bet these quickly get updated to some sort of Android 11-based operating system. I mean, OnePlus doesn't want to keep supporting the old stuff unless they absolutely have to. It's actually cheaper to just support one platform.
Well, it could just be that these phones have been in development for a very long time, right?
Yeah.
The development cycle may have...
Right.
been lengthened because of COVID-19, because of supply chain limitations, and they may have wanted to launch these earlier this year before Android 11 was finalized. It is still interesting, though, that they did not pivot and try to get Android 11 on these phones. It just feels like OnePlus doesn't really know what it's doing. And in this way, I do wonder if, you know, this sort of like, we've heard about this power struggle between Pete Lau and Carl Pei that may have led to Pei's departure from OnePlus. Whether that played into this at all, that's speculation on my part. But you know, this is an interesting strategy. OnePlus is going really cheap and trying to hit every possible price segment, and it'll be interesting to see if it actually works.
Do you know the one thing that I think they totally should have done is yank three of those cameras off the back of that phone and knock another $50 off the price?
Yep, because three of those cameras are not going to be worth anything.
Well, we can't say that. That depends on, you know, a lot on Qualcomm, and Qualcomm's been pretty good at, you know, building pictures out of the photos that your camera takes. They're not going to be the best camera. They're probably going to be adequate, which is good enough for most people. But I just don't see the value proposition of adding a whole bunch of cameras to the back of a phone that does nothing more than increase the price. You know what? I guess what I'm trying to say is people that are looking for a phone with ultra wide and macro and telephoto aren't looking to buy that phone for $200.
I think this is just endemic of a larger issue in the phone industry, right? Google had it. I think Google has the right strategy here with the Pixel 4a. It has a single really high quality camera that just works.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I think the race to, you know, get five blades on your Razr is really just ruining smartphone photography, and OnePlus is definitely contributing to it. Samsung probably more so, but I agree. I think they should have doubled down on making the primary sensor as good and as large as they can afford for this price. Maybe giving you a second, right, an ultra wide, which the sensor doesn't need to be of enormous, you know, of great quality. You can get away with it, and just leave it there. Don't put monochrome. Don't worry about terrible macro lenses. Like just don't. They don't. Nobody uses them.
I do like though that they spent the time and money to put a 90 hertz display on it. That's one of those things that you don't know you needed until you've actually used one and then went back. So that's going to make the experience a lot better, and people aren't even going to realize it. You realize why. They're just going to know, hey, this new phone I bought was pretty cheap, and I love the way this display is and how fast it seems. So I think that was smart.
So it's really interesting. Last year, around the OnePlus 7T launch, Carl Pei said that every phone the company releases going forward will have a high refresh rate. And this would indicate that now they've gone back on that, because yes, the N10 does have a 90 hertz display, but the N100 does not.
Oh, it doesn't. Well, boo.
I don't think so.
Boo. See, I should read more. You're probably right.
I may have flubbed that, but I don't think so. I mean, it's $179. Like, I feel like it doesn't. No, it doesn't. It has a 6.52 inch HD plus IPS display, and
yep.
That's it. 5,000 milliamp hour battery.
Yep.
But no high refresh rate screen. So
I'm reading that too. See, I should have read before I spoke.
But it's true. It's just, no, the N10 does. The N100 does not.
Yeah.
So it's just, anyway, yeah. Good luck getting a 90 hertz display on a $200 phone. So maybe next year.
Right.
I don't know. We'll see. I'm going to review the N10, and I look forward to it. I'm hopeful, but I'm hopeful, but I'm also kind of, I have very, very limited expectations for it. All right, let's talk about hating Google's new icons, because this is something that is blown up this week over Google's recent G Suite redesign. It's now called Google Workspace. A lot of the app icons all of the app icons in Google Workspace have been redesigned. Ara, walk us through this, because this has been a journey for Google, and the journey has been highly criticized, and it seems like they can't even figure out what they want to do with these icons.
I'm somebody who loves a really well-designed icon, and they could have done some really good things here, but I think they just went a little bit too far in one particular idealist direction that didn't really pan out. Because for most of these icons, all of the like main core services all have all four of the Google colors in them. They don't need that, because now when all of those icons are really, really small in a pinned tab on Google Chrome or in a sea of icons in your app drawer, all of those icons are going to look the same. Like, especially between like the, I want to say this is Google Docs and Calendar. That's the same icon turned upside down and with a number in it. I mean, like, really, guys? There were so many ways that this could have gone better. And what sucks is all of these icons are going to look terrible in grayscale and are going to look terrible when they're done just, like, in straight black and white. The first time I got a Gmail notification with the new logo and the new notification logo, I was like, what the heck is this little bow tie thingy in here?
Yeah, see, I thought it was
Gmail.
A butterfly. Yeah.
Same that's here. Gmail. That's the little M in an outline. Holy crap, that's hard to read.
I'm saying to myself, whatever app is putting this stupid notification up there, I'm deleting it. And then it was Gmail.
time to go to Outlook, buddy. They had this whole beautiful process that they went through about how they arrived at these icons, and I really... A for effort, guys, but come on, this is stuff that needs to be usable and readable and glanceable. And these icons are not, especially for the new Google Drive icon and most of the subservices within Google Drive, like Slides, Sheets, Keep, all of those. We needed something better here. We needed something simpler. And y'all went primary colors and kindergarten more than y'all went simplicity and modernism.
It kind of overcommits to one particular, you know, design ethos and color scheme. And I see what Google's trying to do here. It's consistent to a fault, and I don't think it benefits any of the it doesn't benefit any of the usage of this software, right? But,
nope.
But the interesting thing is that this uniformity, there's this meme going around about what Google sees, right? They see the various unique designs and shapes, and it really just, because they're all the same color, it really, the only way to differentiate it is the shape of these icons. And the shapes are so generic and indistinct that it's very easy to get, say, Google Drive confused with Google Home. And this meme is that what Google sees and what you see are very different things. And I just wonder how long it'll take for Google to sort of accept defeat here, or are they going to double down and just really just commit to this long term?
I've seen 6 different ways to fix these icons. I'm looking at one from Reddit right now, and Even just backing away from the all of these app icons need to have all 4 colors in them would make things markedly better. Like, it's okay for some of these services to only be blue or only be red or only be green. I do not need a rainbow in everything.
Don't dare Google to do anything, or they'll get, you know, the ghost of Pablo Picasso to paint something.
No. I've got icon packs, and I've got Icon Pack Studio. I don't have to care about these new icons on my home screen or my app drawer for at least another year. And by then, hopefully, they will have gotten their act together.
See, I don't know. The only one I care about is the Gmail one, because I get so many Gmail notifications, and I'm so used to seeing the little envelope. Now, when I see that little butterfly, I don't have any clue what it is till I open it. But I mean, you know, as long as the software is good, I don't care what the icon looks like.
Yeah, I mean, it's a small thing, but it's a really small thing that you can mess up in a really big way.
You know, they've thickened the lines, obviously. They've made everything not just the same colors, but the thickness of each line, the curve radius is basically the same across all of them now. It's basically just made up of triangles at the edges, except for a couple of them.
It's like one of those building block sets,
right? My daughter plays with these blocks every day.
And they just gave a box full of these blocks to a designer and said, "Okay, you have to make every single one of the Google Workspace icons using nothing but these blocks and these 4 colors."
So now we know that Daniel's daughter designed
she
the icons
would have done a better job than Google. But my question is, where does Google go from here? Right? Because this is not something that they could easily, I mean, they could, I guess, just acquiesce and say, "No, we messed up. We're going to go back to what we used to have. But is there a road for Google to sort of accept defeat while also maintaining its current design, the sort of overarching idea of uniformity?
Double down on detailing and change your and be more consistent with your color scheme, in that letting the colors of the original service logos shine through more.
Do you know what they could do that would work on the desktop and on your phone? Is put a white rounded rectangle behind each and every one.
You shut your mouth.
That would make it easy to distinguish.
We already have that. That's what adaptive icons are. It's going to be all of these logos, even smaller, in a white whatever, circle, square, squircle, whatever adaptive icon shape you have. So that's part of why they're all going to be hard to read.
I feel like they're just hypnotizing me. Like, the longer I stare at them, the more sleepy I get. So I agree. These are bad. It's not, people are not liking them, and Google will have to do something about them because, woof. That is all I have to say about that. Quickly, before we go to break, I want to talk about the Google Play Music, the death knell of Google Play Music. Ara wrote up a beautiful piece on it today. You called it Remembering Google Play Music, a mixtape for my favorite streaming music service. Let's talk about this. What is what's going through your mind right now, Ara?
It's the end of an era. I'm very, very sad because this was the first Google service that I had actual, real, personal passion about. Like, I used Gmail and I used Docs and Drive and all that when I was in high school for stuff. Well, when I was in college for stuff. But Google Play Music was one of those things that I saw it and when I heard about it, I was like instantly, oh, I'm going to use the crap out of that because it had the music locker that you could use for free. And it was like, oh, I'm getting an Android phone whenever I next upgrade and I can't use iTunes on that. 20,000 songs, I can stream them anywhere for free, sold. And it was beautiful, and it was glorious, and it was dark when I first got there, and then 2013 rolled around, and they added All Access, which is great, because now we had a subscription instead of having to pay for every song individually, but then they made the app orange and white.
I just remember when they bought Songza, when Google bought Songza and started integrating those playlists, which I still think are the best playlists any service had.
I still miss some of the Play Music playlists, but I will say it's still scary how well YouTube Music got me within the first day of getting on that, on the beta, the preview, whenever they did the relaunch. Because I opened up the new version, I hit your mixtape, and the next 4 hours were just a blur of all of these songs that I absolutely adored.
All right, so YouTube Music is the future. What's the timeline for getting YouTube Music to... I mean, obviously Google is not trying to recreate Google Play Music because...
Which is hilarious because that's actually exactly what they've done. It's another service that's very slow to get bugs fixed. It's another service that's very slow to get new features. We still don't have casting right on this service. This service has not had casting right since 2015 and still hasn't managed to fix that. A Google service. Google Cast is made by Google, and YouTube Music cannot cast with repeat or shuffle on. That is ridiculous.
YouTube Music doesn't make me beg to allow Google to let me use it on the phones that I paid for, even though I'm a paying customer. So
yeah, so long as you don't download, it instantly beats it for that. It's a matter of, so long as you don't download videos on that phone, you're golden.
And that's what really torqued me about Play Music is when they started enforcing only three
the device
a year.
Limit. No, 10 phones a year and 4 deauthorizations.
I'm not a thief. I'm not going to beg you for permission. Screw you. I just stopped using it.
Really, though, like, that's a limitation that doesn't affect people who aren't phone reviewers. 10 phones a year and deauths a year?
No. 10 devices, period. If you used it on your Android TV, that would take up one of your slots. If you used it with the mini player or uploaded or downloaded music through a computer, each one of those computers got counted as well. You were only allowed 5 phones and 10 devices.
I hit that limit a couple of times over the years as well. I just don't think it was applicable to most normal phone/Google users. Like, I get it. It was stupid and it shouldn't have been there. It doesn't exist on other...
It's something that impacts enthusiasts, but I don't know many non-enthusiasts that were Google
Hence
Play Music
the
subscribers.
Reason it died,
this was
Ara.
Not a service
like,
that appealed
YouTube is
to
YouTube as a
the
brand
masses.
People understand. Millions of people use YouTube for watching billions of hours a week. Like, they see the name YouTube. They associate it with music. The branding exercise makes sense. The fact that Google is upselling you on YouTube Music all the time when you're in the YouTube app, or they say, watch this music video in YouTube Music so you can go and download the app. That is a natural Googleism, right? They just do the thing that gets you to download the app, that gets you to upsell, to subscribe, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, but then the free tier of Google Play Music has an ad every 5 songs. You can't close the app. You have to keep the app on your screen to keep listening. And let's not forget this, Jim. If you have kids and you want to use YouTube Music, get ready for a world of annoyance, because you can't use the mini player for most kids' songs, meaning you have to stay on that page. If you go to even mess with the playlist, the song will pause. That is ridiculously hard. That was something that came about, I think it was either late last year or it was either early this year or late last year, but that came out of the COPPA thing that Google had in regards to kids' content. And that has absolutely messed up YouTube Music if you want to use it as for a family.
Yeah, and Google has said that they are trying to solve this, right? They have to keep kids' privacy. They have to maintain the law while they're doing this. Yep. And
what did the mini player have to do with the law? That's what I want to know. Just like, I couldn't keep listening to a music while I look for the next song.
They just had to make a quick change to be more compliant. And that was a side effect.
This is a symptom of Google doing the quick fix fast. Say that 10 times quick, and then not actually following up on a longer term holistic solution.
It's on a list on somebody's desk somewhere to fix sometime in the future.
Yeah, but they haven't been back to their desk in 9 months, so they have no idea.
Yeah. That sticky note is dried up and fell off the computer by then.
You'll murder them. There will be blood on the walls. I don't think that's a safe.
They'll just delete the entire app after hearing you for 3 hours, Era. They'll just say, forget it.
No, I want in a room with the people who are doing whatever it is with the kids' music. And then I want a whole day with whoever is responsible for casting on YouTube and YouTube Music. Because holy crap, guys.
Well, if you talk to them, tell them to make it YouTube Music play less stuttery on Chrome devices when it's in the background for paying customers.
Yeah.
I don't have that problem on Chrome on Windows or a Mac, just a Chromebook. So fix it.
I haven't really had that issue, but I'm all for making it more consistent on low power devices.
So obviously, if you've been following the Apple side of things, today's the day Apple One launches, which is its bundle subscription plan for all of its services. This was inevitable. They announced it during the iPad event back in September. There are 3 tiers, all of which include Apple Music, right? So this is a way for Apple to upsell you on all of its services, but in particular, you get Apple Music and Apple TV Plus and Apple Arcade and all of the tiers. Apple TV Plus is bad, and unless you want to watch Ted Lasso, which you should, it's great, but you shouldn't pay for Apple Music, Apple TV Plus ever until they have a better, more consistent catalog. Apple Arcade it's not great. It's worth it. It depends on how often you play games on your phone, but in a world where Stadia and xCloud and GeForce Now and Luna and all these other amazing AAA game services that let you play games on your phone exist. Luna does, but that's a different conversation. Apple Arcade is not a great value for $5 a month. That said, there are some really good games, but really it's about Apple Music. Starting at $15 a month, you get Music, TV Plus, Arcade, and 50 gigs of iCloud, which is insulting. You get
You can't talk about Apple One without talking about how utterly insulting
there.
I'm just going through these storage amounts.
The family plan is $20 a month. You get Music, TV, Arcade, and 200 gigs of iCloud. Still insulting. The only good deal here is $30 a month. You get Music, TV Plus, Arcade, 2 terabytes of iCloud storage, plus Apple News Plus, plus Fitness Plus, which is coming later this year. For people who are all in on Apple, that's a really good deal. But I do want to bring it back to music specifically here, because Apple Music is the same cost as all the other music streaming services. It's $10 a month for individuals, $15 a month for a family plan. in a world where Apple One exists, Ara, and you've written about this on the site, Google really needs to step up its game and offer YouTube Music as part of a better bundle, not just with YouTube Premium.
Well, that bundle should not be focused around YouTube Music at all. YouTube Music should just be included in app in YouTube Premium, and if you want YouTube Music, pay for YouTube Premium, because you're going to get just as much, if not more, value out of removing ads on the regular YouTube app. But because we already have Google One, and Google One is technically a bundle because you get all of these other features in Google One, including a VPN coming soon, which that'll be great that I'll be already paying for one. But for Google, they need to center these bundles around one of three different things. They either need to center it around YouTube Premium, they need to center it around Google Workplace and make G Suite accounts a little bit more accessible, but also make them break less things. Because if you have a G Suite account, traditionally new features don't work for you, and if you have any troubleshooting, things get 10 times harder to fix. Or they need to, the third thing that they could technically try to surround it around is just the storage in the photos. Because Google Photos is a great service, and especially now that these days, every time you first set up a phone and start setting up your photo backup, it's defaulting to original size instead of free, which is another one of those things that it's a very small change, but it can make a very big difference.
Yeah, it can be expensive for sure. Apple is not, there are no tiers between 200 gigabytes and 2 terabytes of iCloud storage. But I learned that Google One does not offer anything between those sizes either, which is also crazy. It's just that there are bundles lower than that. So you get, I think there's 100 gigs and 200 gigs than 2 terabytes.
But at the same time, 2 terabytes for $10, what other increment between those? Because isn't the 200 gigabytes something like $3 or $4? What other tier would you put in between those two? Like a terabyte for $6?
I don't think 2 terabytes is $4.
No, 2 terabytes is $10 a month.
And you get a VPN that's going to cost you $10 a month if you buy it anywhere else.
I think that's 200 gigabytes. 200 gigabytes a month, I want to say, is like $3 or $4 a month.
I just think that, so for iCloud, like it's basically the same pricing. It works out. It's $129.99 a year for 2 terabytes of iCloud, but it's more expensive on a monthly basis than Google. But what I'm
right,
I happily pay for 2 terabytes on Google One because I use Google Storage. I use Google Photos. I just don't want to have to spend $130 a year for iCloud storage when I only need about 210 gigabytes. You know, like I pay for 200 gigabytes right now because my wife and I share an iCloud account. She stores all of her photos there. I have some backups and stuff, but I was doubling up on photo storage. I just got rid of mine because I already use Google Photos. But I do think that the delta between 200 gigabytes and 2 terabytes is too much and that you should have more options.
Especially for an iPhone, because you can back your iPhone up into your iCloud account.
So you can do the same thing with Google One. Like the photo backups, phone backups are there.
You can literally a complete backup and restore system through iCloud. Just like you have to use, you know, you used to plug it in and use iTunes. You can do that through iCloud now. And that's $200 gigabytes is just not enough. Yeah. Especially if you're going to call it a family plan, you know, that's assuming that you and your spouse or, you know, your partner both have iPhones and maybe a kid with an iPhone. 200 gigs is gone.
Yeah, I agree. Yep. Google One really does need to improve. I do like the idea of adding a free VPN. I think that will be helpful. Privacy experts may not love it, but we'll see.
Yeah, but it's not like the VPN was blocking Google from harvesting your browsing habits anyway.
I mean, a lot of people still already use Google DNS, so might as well just go the extra mile and add a VPN to it.
Yeah. And the VPN that they use is,
it's
Google
great.
Fi
it, does, it just works.
It's good.
Right?
It's fast.
It's extremely, it's reliable.
Yep.
And really, it'll only work for for insecure Wi-Fi hotspots unless you explicitly turn it on.
Yeah, it's not going to change your location. It's not going to be the kind of VPN that you use to right. spoof that you're inside the United States if you're in Europe and want to watch the new Disney Plus content.
Yeah, Google would piss off all their partners if they offered that kind of VPN.
Yeah.
That would be amazing, though, if they gave you the option. It's like, oh, do you want to go to France now?
Yeah, I would.
All right. Let's take a quick break, and we will come back and talk about Snapdragon on Chromebooks. Stay with us. This episode of the Android Central Podcast is brought to you by Indeed. One of the greatest challenges we face is taking all the information that's available and knowing where to focus. It's the same problem with hiring. With Indeed, you have access to the largest pool of talent and can hire the right people fast. Indeed.com is the number one job site in the world because Indeed gets you the best people fast. Unlike other sites, Indeed gives you full control and payment flexibility over your hiring. You only pay for what you need. You can pause your account at any time, and there are no long-term contracts. Plus, Indeed provides powerful tools to make your search that much easier, like sponsored jobs, which are shown to be 3.5 times more likely to result in a hire. With 73% of online job seekers visiting Indeed each month, Indeed is going to get you the most important hire you need, just like they have for over 3 million businesses. And right now, Indeed is offering our listeners a free $75 credit to boost your job post, which means more quality candidates will see it fast. Try Indeed out with a free $75 credit at Indeed.com/ACP. This is their best offer available anywhere. Go right now to Indeed.com/ACP. Terms and conditions apply. Offer valid through December 31st. All right, Ara, Jerry, this is kind of why I wanted both of you on today, not because you weren't great in the first section, but because you're both experts on Chromebooks. And I would like to know what the significance is of Snapdragon on Chromebooks. So the context here is maybe a month ago, Jerry wrote an article about how Chromebooks will never get a custom SoC from Qualcomm like we have on the Surface Pro X. Now right. we do have at least an off-the-shelf Snapdragon chip with the Acer Spin 513. It is a Snapdragon 7C, so it's not super powerful. It is certainly not nearly as powerful as the one in the Surface Pro X, but it's also
no, not
it's
the
also
eight.
An LTE
yeah.
powered.
I wish it was the
you know, it's an LTE chip, so it'll give you cellular connectivity at very good efficiency. Ara, walk us through what this means for Chromebooks as an ecosystem and why Acer may be the company that's putting it out first.
Well, for what this means for Chromebooks is Snapdragon SoCs are great for battery efficiency and also for cellular. As Jerry wrote in his editorial, nobody really does cellular like Qualcomm because they have basically a monopoly on that segment. And having Snapdragon means that we're going to be able to have an LTE or in a couple of years down the road, a 5G Chromebook that will still be able to have the battery life that we expect from a Chromebook. Because if a Chromebook ships with less than 10 hours of battery life, why did you bother? That's worthless. Because Chromebooks are expected to last all day and then some at this point. Like, the Chromebook I have sitting next to me while I'm recording this podcast right now is the Acer 311, which was also reviewed this week. This has, I consistently get over 12 hours of battery life on here. I've gotten 14 hours of battery life on a single charge from this thing before. I've gone literally a day and a half of work before I needed to charge. So having a Snapdragon SoC means that we're going to be able to get LTE and better data connectivity on a Chromebook for those who are working outside of the home or those who are working in areas that traditionally just don't have a whole lot of Wi-Fi infrastructure, places that are outdoors or just moving a lot, and they're going to be able to get a better experience on a Chromebook without having their battery life just instantly tank.
Yeah, which is the problem. There's nothing preventing any company from building a 5G, 4G, LTE, even 3G, whatever, connected Chromebook. That's I'm not going to say it's easy because nothing like that's easy, but it's something that every company could do. But then that 10-hour battery life turns into 5. Doesn't matter what chip you have in it. It kills the battery when you have separate chips for, you know, all of your wireless, including a cellular connection.
Which is why we just haven't seen that many LTE Chromebooks. The last LTE Chromebook that I remember is the Samsung Chromebook Plus.
Yes.
And that was two, three years ago at this point.
And the battery life was not good when you were using LTE. I used the original Google Pixel Book. No, what was it called? Chromebook Pixel.
The Chromebook Pixel.
For way too long, simply because it had an LTE connection. But I was getting three and a half hours of battery life while using it. Those days are gone now. If, you know, Qualcomm fixed it. Let's hope we see more of them.
Yes. And let's hope we see more powerful versions of them. Because while the 7C is going to be capable enough for Chrome, it's also one of those things of now that we're getting into Parallels and Windows applications for Chromebooks, we're having more, Linux is more widely available for enterprise use. It's one of those things of more powerful Chromebooks are something that we're going to want to take more advantage of in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit bummed that it's the 7C instead of
8CX.
CX, the latest one? Yeah.
8CX.
I understand why, but I'm hyped, I'm pumped that it's an off-the-shelf chip because Google is the one that should be adapting Chrome to use off-the-shelf hardware instead of trying to get Qualcomm to build special chips. That saves costs, and it just makes it easier. You know, the Snapdragon 7C is already in the mainline Linux kernel. Let's just use what's already supported and just make it work instead of, you know, negotiating something special. So I'm really glad to see that.
I mean, the 7C is going to be, I think, plenty powerful compared to the Celeron and lower-end MediaTek Chromebooks that I spend most of my time on. Like, I don't think it's going to feel underpowered.
No, it's going to be a good Chromebook chip. I mean, it can run Windows 10. And, Eric, you use both. You know you need a whole lot more resources to run Windows 10 than you do Chrome OS.
Yep.
So it'll be fine.
So I guess the question is, Qualcomm is now it's a vendor for Chromebook manufacturers. It is one of the many. They can use an Intel chip. They can use a Rockchip chip. They can use a MediaTek chip. Yep. They can use now a Qualcomm chip. That is an option. Unlike in phones, the
AMD
and AMD.
Yeah.
Unlike in AMD. Phones, they're not nearly as important a vendor or as powerful a negotiator. But with the rise of Chromebooks in schools and in workplaces just throughout 2020, what does this do to the Chromebook ecosystem in general? Does it bring prices down for these ARM-powered chips or ARM-powered Chromebooks? Does it have an actual impact on performance per watt, given that Qualcomm does this is your bread and butter? Are these even close to being as powerful as the entry-level i3s and, you know, Ryzen 3 series that you see in Chromebooks today?
Yeah. Ideally, it's going to make, you know, MediaTek-powered Chromebooks cheaper. It probably won't, because that just never seems to happen. I don't think it's going to have much of an impact at all on education or enterprise sector, because that's the two different ends of the spectrum. The education market is based on
Android apps.
Yeah, decent Chromebooks that can run the right apps and are tough enough to be abused by younger children if they're in, you know, middle schools. Whereas enterprise is, you know, let's throw an Intel i5 in it and 8 gigs of RAM so it can, you know, run Google apps that we've custom built for our company. So I don't think it's going to have much effect on either of those. This is a pure consumer play. And that's another reason why I'm glad they use an off-the-shelf part. Qualcomm is going to have no say in the update cycle. It's supported in the Linux kernel. It's just, they'll just build a new kernel with all the other stuff they need in it and use what's supported, and it's just going to work.
Yeah, that's especially good news considering Chromebooks get updated for 9 years, possibly 10 years in the next couple of years, because updates just keep lasting longer and longer for these Chromebooks, which is amazing.
I do think there may be a little blowover. People have bought, you know, a nice mid-range $450 Chromebook, and it just so happens they got one with a Snapdragon processor on it. And then they, you know, their kids bring their Chromebook home from school, and it's not nearly as responsive, and it's not nearly as good. There's going to be some questions there that, you know, I guess that's up to the school board to answer. Why are you buying such cheap laptops for our kids? Well, the answer is because they have to buy 5,000 of them.
Well, and also, a lot of school districts do planned obsolescence through their Chromebooks. It's a matter of your child keeps the Chromebook for... If your child gets issued a Chromebook ninth grade, and then when they graduate 12th grade, they get to keep the laptop because it's old enough that it would have needed to be replaced anyway.
Yeah, but that's the only real thing I can think of. I don't know, Eric, can you think of another way that it's going to affect, you know, cheaper or more expensive Chromebooks?
I wouldn't necessarily frame it in regards to price, Jerry, but there are certain things that you can only do on Intel-powered Chromebooks right now. And having more Snapdragon and AMD and MediaTek Chromebooks out there can hopefully encourage developers and Google to make sure that more of these things are supported on non-Intel Chromebooks.
Oh, yeah, like Linux apps. Apps should work just fine on, like, the Acer 513, I think is the one that's coming with the Snapdragon.
Yep.
But they're not officially supported on anything except MediaTek processors. Officially. Everybody uses them on ROC chips and, you know, other ARM Chromebooks, but, you know, this Chromebook isn't going to be officially supported. So if there's bugs, that just means Google's going to have to work and make it better.
Yeah. The beauty of having another chip maker and a chip maker that is used to having a whole lot of pull is that hopefully Google will get better at making sure that all processor types can be supported for all features wherever it is feasible given the power of the chip. Like, I don't want every single Chromebook to be capable of running Parallels and Windows apps, but I do want every single Chromebook to be capable of doing GeForce Now, Stadia, xCloud at a decent frame rate and being able to run regular Linux apps, maybe not, you know, CAD or Steam. Well, Steam needs to be supported on all types, but Steam needs to be supported everywhere.
And that's in Google's best interest to do that too. So, and hey, speaking of that, the Snapdragon has an actual decent GPU in it. Once Google finds a way to support GPUs in Chrome, Steam will be a nice little trick on your Snapdragon Chromebook. You can actually play some games.
All right, quickly, what is going on with this Chrome OS 86 update? Seems to be the update was pulled because of bugs. We don't usually hear about this kind of thing from the silent Chrome OS updates.
I mean, this is the second or third time this has happened in the last 18 months where an update actually managed to get to the stable channel with some kind of catastrophic bug and then got paused, and then the rollout continued once they fixed the issue. The issue this time was, instead of this just being something that forced you to power wash your Chromebook in order to get things back to normal, this was a kernel update that completely and irreversibly bricked a number of Pixelbooks and a couple of other Chromebooks, if memory serves. But Pixelbooks are big. Pixelbooks are expensive, and their users are very, very vocal when things go wrong with them.
Yeah, I saw somebody had an interesting hypothesis. The people whose Pixelbooks in particular got bricked, did they ever bother to install the Intel bytecode update? And, you know, that would be interesting.
It's a Chromebook. They should not be responsible for any update ever.
That was a very difficult and special update that, you know, you had to boot into bootloader mode and let it sit, and it updated just like updating the BIOS on you know, any other computer. And I'm sure a lot of people skipped that because it wasn't just restart and it fixed. So I'm sure a lot of people did skip that, and I just wonder if there's any correlation.
Well, you can't really skip any Chrome OS updates, but more importantly, Jerry, I've had firmware updates with Chrome OS updates before, and they are handled the same as any other update. It's just it boots to a different screen before it goes to your login.
This one was not. This one came from Intel. Remember the those big flaws they found in the Intel CPUs, Meltdown Inspector?
Yeah.
This was to address that for Chrome. And it came from Intel, and it was different. It wasn't hard, but it was different. And people don't like different.
Well, more importantly, if you sell a Chromebook on the basis of you will never have to deal with updates or security or anything on your Chromebook ever.
Oh, I agree.
Something happens and you don't immediately be like, okay, we're going to take care of this for you.
Right.
To make sure it doesn't screw things up later. That's on Google, which is why... there was some confusion at the beginning, but they are going to replace the Pixel books that got bricked during the initial wave of the update.
Yeah, I think probably what happened there is once enough complaints were received, they said, uh-oh, something is going on. And, you know, at first it was like, well, your Chromebook died. I'm sorry, it's out of warranty. And they just didn't want to listen, but then they realized they had to listen. You know, confusion and not having the right people work the help desk was kind of the problem there, I think. But I'm glad that they're replacing. Hey, if that happened to you and your Pixel book got bricked, you're lucky because you're getting a new Pixel book.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, that's at this point in the that support cycle, then yeah, you're lucky you're getting a refurbished Pixel book.
Right, but it's got an extra a year warranty on it, so you're good to go.
All right, well, I think we're gonna leave the conversation there. Let's finish up this episode by talking about a few things that are making us happy this week, and then we can let people go and enjoy their weekends. So, Ara, I'll start with you. What is making you happy right now?
I'm being a complete and utter Disney nerd this week, and very happy that. This month has had a couple of good things for cartoons. The first is today, October the 30th, the first season of The Owl House got added to Disney Plus, and that is a very interesting and new show. I'm very happy with the LGBTQ representation in that show, and it's very fun. I don't have cable, so this is going to be my first time getting to watch it this weekend, so I'm very excited for that. But also the reboot for DuckTales has had a very interesting arc this month. They did a Darkwing Duck episode that's going to serve as a spinoff for hopefully a whole new show. And that was adorable and awesome. And it's free on YouTube, so go watch it right now. But those have been making me happy.
Woo!
Jerry, what's making you happy?
Seeing a new Chromebox. I'm not going to lie. I think the Chromebox is the... I don't want to say that word, even though you might have already said it, but I think the Chromebox is it. If you don't need a super powerful gaming desktop and you want a desktop computer, you should be buying a Chromebox. That was kind of tough to say when we went 2 years without seeing a new Chromebox, but now we got one from HP that was supposed to release sometime in October, but like we're recording this on the 30th and it hasn't yet, so maybe not. And then Acer is bringing one out the beginning of next year, which we reviewed on the site, and it's the bomb. And I love seeing them because I'm getting tired of having an old one here. I want to see new stuff, new affordable stuff. And now's a great time to introduce new affordable stuff.
Jerry, the Chromebox G3 is in pre-order on B&H, but it's only the Celeron, not the i3.
Ah, see, I went to HP, and they don't even have a detailed listing of it yet.
No, ridiculous. But it should be coming. I will say Chromebook availability has suffered this year, but I'm very hopeful that the Chromeboxes will arrive sooner rather than later, because we absolutely need them. They're good Chromeboxes in particular are good family computers of its. Okay, we want something that the kids can use, but we don't want them taking it into their bedroom and doing God knows what on it while we're trying to do get chores done or can't supervise them.
Unpopular opinion, since we're an Android podcast, forget the Android TV, get a Visa mount and put a Chromebox on the back of your television. Then you have everything.
I mean, that's like hardcore Android Central. I think that's actually better.
Okay, Good.
I mean, if you got one of those, upgraded the hard drive, then you could have the offline Disney Plus videos on it. Then yeah, that's
these new Chromeboxes. They use standard M.2 SSDs. You take out four screws, open it, unscrew the SSD, and plop a great big one in there instead.
And
I
then
love it.
Reinstall the OS from the Chrome remote utility tool.
Right, and that's simple. Instructions are online. It's easy. They're user upgradable. They're everything I love, all wrapped up into one little shiny aluminum box.
Beautiful. Now go write that article, Jerry.
Yep. Better you than me.
All right. Well, what's making me happy this week? I have just received. Actually, today it is still in the box. I haven't even opened it. It is my first real espresso machine. I am so excited about this.
Did you buy that on Prime Day?
I did not. I actually traded it. I have a bunch of old gear that I bought, some camera gear, an old laptop, an old Dell laptop that I bought a couple of years ago when I was testing out Windows, and a couple of phones. I sent my Galaxy S10e that I bought 2 years ago or last year. I don't know what is time. Anyway, I traded it with somebody who is in the coffee industry and, like me, has a bunch of extra coffee equipment. And the stars aligned and we made it work. And I'm so excited because I've never owned a good espresso machine before. It is a Breville Barista Pro. So it's not like a super high end, like Italian best of the best, but it's as a starter machine, it'll do just fine. So,
but yeah, home users don't need to be pumping steam. You know,
this is not messing around. Like this is not commercial grade in the sense that like a coffee shop would not buy this, but it has the same, it's got the same quality of components as a commercial machine. So it's got a dual boiler. But it's got a very, very high quality grinder. It's just a very solid home espresso machine.
I just meant the ones where you have to read the gauge and pull the great big handle.
No, although
maybe
that's
I'm old.
Down the road, once I have my own, my dream kitchen is twice the size of my current one, and I do want that. But my wife would not be happy if I bought one of those. So
she's smarter than any
espresso machine at a time.
So Bader, how long before you introduce your daughter to coffee?
I've been there, done that.
Oh,
she's not really like a lot, but just like the dregs of one of my coffee cups. She likes it. It's so cute, Ara. She's so happy.
Yeah, my kids loved it.
It's like Dada's coffee, my coffee. It's so cute. I'll record it the next time she has some. It's amazing.
See, we love espresso here at the house, and all you can
too
seem
bitter,
to,
too bitter.
All you can seem to buy is stuff with a bunch of milk and all these crazy names. We just like a little cup of espresso.
Yeah, exactly. There's a time and place, right?
Right.
Time and place.
And it's we had one, an espresso machine, and it was not a good one. And it didn't last a year before it gave up the ghost. Probably put 500 cups through it, but it still should have lasted longer than that. So it's cool that you got a good one. You're going to have to invite me up there.
I'm excited. Yeah, when the world ends and you want to come up and stay in Canada, you're
the espresso could keep
here.
Us warm.
Exactly. All right. Well, that's the show. If you have any feedback, send it to podcast@androidcentral.com. We love hearing from you. Jerry is at GB Hill. Ara is at Ara Wagco. I am at Journey Dan. We are all at Android Central. We are back next week with our 499th episode. Then the week after is our 500 episode extravaganza. We will have a nice big show for you then with some special guests. So stay tuned for that. Thank you again for listening. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Adios.